Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good evening and welcome to
Foment About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izett.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Rachel Jacobs.
And we're your co-hosts through this weekly journey through all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. This is episode 206, and we're really excited to be here. It is hot, so if you got a window, open it.
It might be too hot.
I have to say that
I don't think opening a window is going to help.
So we have zero air conditioning in our apartment right now. So sitting in this little air conditioned studio is pretty awesome, and I am even more happy to be here than normal.
Who knew a shipping container could be so comfortable?
I know. So announcements. I think I mentioned this last time I was on, but the New Mexico Fermentation Fest is coming up on Saturday, June 24th in Albuquerque. If you want more information, it is nmfermentationfest.com.
nmfermentationfest.com.
What are we missing this week, Kuzmi?
What are we missing? Oh, we're missing the National Home Brewers Conference. I'm very sad to miss this. I'm really, really sad to miss it. Something I don't ever want to miss. But there's just too much ado here in New York City. Among them, on Wednesday, I'm part of a panel with Patrick McGovern at the Brooklyn Historical Society, and we are talking about historical ferments. He's got a new book coming out called Ancient Brews. It's a great book. It looks great. It's got a lot of really great information in it. And if you are in Brooklyn, please check it out at the Brooklyn Historical Society. But if you're not, and you're going to Minneapolis, go to the National Home Brewers Conference and report back to Mary and I about how awesome it was and how we totally should have been there, because I lament not being able to be there.
Yes, we will miss everyone this year, but I hope everybody has fun and learns a lot and tastes a lot of good homebrew. This Wednesday here in Brooklyn, we have Beer Geek Trivia, Finn Back to the Future at Gloria Tibaldi. It's hosted by the Bearded Ladies, and there will be tap specials and prizes. And there's a Facebook page. You could probably find out more if you Google it as well. That's Beer Geek Trivia, Finn Back to the Future at Gloria Tibaldi. Tuesday, June 20th is Summerfest, Wheezy and Strong Rope Family Dinner. This is with some of our favorite past guests, Louise Leonard and Jason Saylor of Strong Rope Brewery. It is going to be from 7 to 9. It's $75 for four courses with beer pairings. It is actually vegetarian this time. I'm so sorry I can't go. It'll be awesome. Go to strongropebrewery.com to find out more.
But that's not the only pairing going on this month. Oh, my God. On June 21st, Foster Sundry at KCBC Beer and Cheese Tasting at 7 to 9. Is that at Foster Sundry or at KCBC?
At KCBC.
At KCBC. Both of them are right off Troutman in Bushwick, and they are both doing awesome things. Aaron Foster is one of our favorite cheesemongers in the area. Really great guy, really knowledgeable, can tell you everything you want to know and more. And we haven't had him on the show yet, but we are going to make that happen, I promise.
That's true. And then Tuesday, June 27th, another cool fermented pairing, beer and cheese pairing, Beer Freak U with Crown Finish Caves and Coney Island Brewery. That's 8 to 10 p.m. You can find tickets on Eventbrite, and I'm actually going to be at that one.
Awesome.
With July 9th, what's coming
July 9th, we're getting down with Steve Brill and doing some foraging in Prospect Park. I cannot wait, but we are basically doing a foraging trek, private tour. You can go to bitternesters.com. I'm doing it with John LaPala. And then we are basically, it's in hopes of being inspired to make beer with something, some of our local ingredients, either foraged in the park or inspired by things that we see in the park, much akin to beers made by walking by Eric Steen. But Stan Hieronymus is coming to town on August 19th, and we hope to share some of these beers at Fifth Hammer Brewing Company when he comes to town. We're excited to celebrate that.
That sounds really awesome, guys.
And we'll come back from that with some good tips on how you, too, can organize a foraging expedition in your part of the woods.
In the meanwhile, it's a little bit too hot to go outside.
Yes. So we're in the midst of a heat wave here in New York City. It's only our second little time period above 90. I think it's 93 right now. Excellent, according to the Magic Watch. So let's talk about our favorite heat wave frozen treat. So I recently got some new silicone popsicle molds from Flying Tiger,
nice.
Which is this cool little,
little Danish dollar store
essentially.
Company,
yeah. Yes.
So I bought a milk frother. It's great.
Yes. That I also bought my last milk frother there. But anyway, so popsicles are great for the summer. You can make them out of pretty much anything. So I recently made some roasted strawberry, coconut, and yogurt popsicles. So I just roasted it. I drizzled some strawberries. Actually, these were strawberries that were like past eating, but not rotten, but like, you know, in that like slightly mushy stage. Yeah. So I just drizzled them with some balsamic vinegar, roasted them for I think 20 minutes in our toaster oven because it's too hot to turn on the real oven.
What kind of yogurt did you use?
I don't remember what kind of yogurt we had. It wasn't my homemade yogurt. It could have been.
Excuse me, do you remember?
It's Trader Joe's yogurt.
But okay. I just wanted to bring it up because it's hot enough to be making your own yogurt now, right?
That's true.
I'll just like lay it in your apartment to incubate.
Yes. Well, there is room temperature yogurt, but yes, it's really easy to make thermophilic yogurt right now. But anyway, after the strawberries have cooled a little bit, I just mixed them with some yogurt, a teeny bit of coconut extract. I just used some agave syrup. You can use whatever sweetener you want. And I sweetened it to taste. I actually used my immersion blender and then stuck it in these popsicle molds. And it's great, especially when you want a semi-healthy treat for when it's so hot out. It's also good for breakfast.
Yeah.
I know. Actually, you could add granola into it. You could put like granola
at the bottom and then have
full breakfast.
Oh, man, that sounds great.
The other thing I was reading about what I haven't tried is kombucha slushies.
Hmm.
So you can take frozen fruit, like frozen strawberries or blueberries or whatever. We're in the peak of fruit season for a lot of us, right, around the country. So whatever fruit is in season and looks really good at your local farmer's market or market, take that, pop it in the freezer, and then just blend that with kombucha, and you can have your kombucha fruit kombucha slushy. I think you could also add like some herbal tea or a little bit of natural extracts or
other flavor.
And you can make tea out of anything, right?
Yeah.
You can make like a basil strawberry kombucha slushy. Anyway, I haven't tried it yet, but I think it'll be good. I'm obsessed with slushies in the summertime.
I've been thinking a lot about mare milk and yak milk lately.
I think you're lying.
I'm not lying. My friend Paul just went to Mongolia, and he's in Mongolia now. And hopefully, you know, he's roughing it, and hopefully he'll get like some kind of Ferment About It Abroad interviews for us about fermented yak milk. But I don't know. I was thinking about this with this yogurt thing. I wonder if they make yak milk popsicles out there.
I know they make the yak milk yogurt, right?
Yeah.
Or like the butter, which is supposed to be like a really good treat.
Yep. Just don't milk the wrong mare.
Rachel, what are you thinking about during the summertime?
Actually, I was just having this discussion with my roommate. So they don't really like drinking beer, but during the summer especially, I'll make a lot of Sima, which is, you know, just a kind of a fermented lemon drink. It's slightly alcoholic lemonade, which is good because you don't really want to be drinking too much alcohol if you're going to be out in the sun a lot. It's just not a good idea. So just lemons, water, sugar, and then just yeast and let it go for like a week. And then it's good to drink. It's refreshing. It's tasty. It's a little bit alcoholic, so it's always fun.
Would also make an excellent slushy, I think.
I don't know. Well, yeah, I guess it's not alcoholic enough to not freeze. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you could probably just, you could. I mean, depending on how much alcohol you ended up with, I think you could just freeze it into a partial slush.
Oh, yeah.
And then blend it, or, you know.
Yeah, or you can or have like
blend
a frozen
it,
lemonade,
you know, or cut it with ice.
Vodka in it. It's great.
Yeah. How about the Chrissies? We haven't introduced our guest, but what are you drinking? What's your favorite thing to drink this summer?
Right now?
Yeah.
Oh, I believe it or not, as I learned yesterday, as and actually Chris saw me yesterday, I was a little dehydrated and had reached for a beer and then realized that I should just be guzzling water at that point, especially after 13 miles of bike riding and 2.5 miles of running over the course of a 95 degree day.
You were a swim away from a triathlon.
A mini triathlon.
A mini triathlon. This is Chris O'Leary of Briork, New York, and welcome back to the show. We haven't had you on since episode
132. September 2015.
That was right before GABF.
Yeah, that's usually when we try and ping you, because you, outside of people officially in the profession of making beer and selling beer, I think have been to more breweries than anybody I know.
There are probably people who have been around longer more than me and probably been to a lot more that closed, like, say, during the 90s and early 2000s, too.
That's fair.
But you're at 138 new brewery visits this year.
This year.
And that's new. Only new ones.
That's only new.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Yeah. That's not even counting the ones that I've revisited, which I think, you know, I kind of just kind of tried to do the count in my head, and there's probably another 40 or so that I've revisited this year. So, just in my travels, and, you know, like, I was back in Minneapolis, went to Surly, I was back in Denver, and went to a few old standbys like Ratio Beer Works, one of my favorites there. You know, here in New York, we have plenty to visit. Yeah. You know, every weekend I could visit a brewery, and every weekend that I'm in town, probably not get to all of them. You know, if I went to one a weekend, so it's great.
I still want to go back. What kind of beer? So when you are properly hydrated, what beers are you drinking?
This time,
or what
in
are you
this weather, a Berliner Weiss. Yes. I mean, absolutely. There's, you know, there was a brewery that I was at in Michigan last weekend, and it was pretty hot there, and it was kind of one of those places where, you know, they want to warn you that what you're ordering is sour. I'm like, no, I know that it's sour, but it's also 3.5%, and it's exactly what I want to be drinking right now.
Yeah.
So, that's my go-to style. I wish there were more, you know, I'm sitting here looking at a can that I brought, and I'm like, I wish there were more Berliner Weisses in cans.
Yes.
Agreed.
You know?
I think we'll see that, though, because think about just how many more Berliner Weisses are being Berliner Weiss style beers are being brewed now, as opposed to even like 2 years ago.
Yep.
And how many
more cans there are now.
Exactly.
I think
the two will come together.
Packaging.
We will realize that more.
Yeah.
Well, because some people have been putting simple, you know, I like straight up sours or whatever.
Yeah.
Kind of the simpler sours in cans.
Yeah.
How about you, Kuzme? What are you drinking?
When
you're properly hydrated?
Water. Well, after the water?
Yes.
Flavored water. Beer-flavored water. No, I definitely agree with Chris here. Like, Berliner Weiss is kind of really where I want to be. I'll even go with a Gosa. But that tart, light, refreshing beer just satisfies your thirst. But I'll move on from that, of course.
Of course, I
don't often drink just one.
Start
and then I go. So I go
work your way towards an imperial stout.
Yes.
95-degree day.
Yeah. Well, that's I don't. So I, you know, if we studied what I did yesterday, right? I started with a small sour. They had a cherry sour and an apricot sour that was really nice. It was Big Alice's 4th anniversary, so happy birthday, Big Alice. We played with the home musicians, and it was great. We had a really great time.
You guys rocked the house.
It was
a lot of fun.
It was really fun. The sound was good. There was good energy everywhere.
I could hear it from two blocks away,
too.
I was, like, walking up, and I'm like, oh, they're on stage. It's going to be a fun day.
Yeah, we did not go lightly into that set. It was good. And the sound system was good, which is a rarity for these kind of gigs. I mean, they had like 9.5% their anniversary beer that they had barrel aged in there. Like, it took me a while to get to that, but once I had that a little bit, I went back to just IPAs and hoppy, like, just crisp, hop forward, stuff is kind of where I land.
I know. I actually rarely, I go back and forth between IPAs, but I'll drink IPAs in the summer.
Yeah.
And session IPAs, those, anything in that hoppy realm. But also huge shout out to all the breweries doing pilsners and lagers right now.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Which is great. That's one thing I've been trying to stay home more and like sew and weave and do home body kind of stuff. And I've had the Rockaways Pilsner and Flagship's lager, and that has been great to be able to drink like local New York City brewed lagers and pilsners.
Yeah, Therese has a good pilsner.
Yeah, I mean, that's many, many. Like, KCBC's done, obviously, Kelso.
That KCBC Finback one, yes. Too.
How about Meow? How soon is Meow?
Yeah. How soon is Meow?
And that was a rice pilsner. So, at what point does it become... Where is it no longer? Where is it no longer?
I'm okay with like just lumping everything. It's a log, like a light colored lager.
Yes.
Well, we
straw a well done straw colored lager is my shit right now. Besides, you know, the simpler sours, low alcohol sours. Anyway, so how many? 138.
138 for the year.
Oh my goodness.
And 852 lifetime.
Lifetime, 852.
Yeah. Lifetime is like the last 9 years, though, no?
Yeah, well, my first one was in 2003, but most of them have come within the last, like, 4 years. Like, I think I went from, like, 25 in a year in, like, 2012 to, well, I'm on pace now. I mean, think about it. We're less than halfway through the year. Yeah. I could, in theory, I won't get to 300, but, you know. I'll be happy if I finish a little over 200. Oh, I'm going to try to take it easy this summer.
And then, and some of those breweries. Okay, wait. We're going to take a short break. But before we take a short break, what are the cities that you've been to so far? Can you list them all, or some of the highlights, or some of the newer places?
Nashville, Vancouver, San Diego. Which, I mean, you can never run out of. I've visited fewer breweries this year than are in San Diego County. So I've been to London and Manchester. I've been to Northern Michigan, I mentioned. I've been back to Denver and managed to even visit close to a dozen new breweries there, because you go away for 6 months and, you know, 12 new breweries open in Colorado. I mean, those were the standouts. I think that I know we'll talk a little more about this, but Vancouver really surprised me this time, because I had never expected, you know, really the only beer city we hear about in Canada that really has a lot of influence in the States is Montreal.
Mm-hmm. And Toronto to some degree. Not as much U.S. influence, you're right.
Right. But Vancouver is really making some impressive beer. And you know, it's a natural fit because of its proximity to the Pacific Northwest. Right. But yeah, I think we've... I've put some good effort in this year to get my number up and explore places where, you know, beer is not the first thing you think of. Charlotte, North Carolina, that's another one that, you know, we talk about Asheville a lot, but Charlotte's really making some incredible beer right now. You know, it's for me now, it's getting off the beaten path. It's great to go to Denver and Portland and San Diego, but it's exploring new scenes that may be just under the radar now, and seeing what they have to offer. And there's some real, I don't even want to say diamonds in the rough, because I would say on average there's more good beer than not good beer in a lot of these, you know, urban areas especially, but where breweries kind of influence each other over time and people leave and start their own places. So, you know, you have a lot more experienced commercial brewers. I think that exploration has made it so that you can go to any city and find good beer. Whereas, you know, 10 years ago when I started visiting breweries, it was like, well, you go to Denver and you go to Portland and, you know, you go to San Diego and, you know, that's it.
Yeah. Or if you go to these other towns, sometimes you'd be like, oh, there's a brew pub. Oh, it's not very good.
Yeah.
It's all or you know,
it's a
they have
it's
like
a chain brew pub.
Yes. Or there's a couple good beers, but it's not like, oh my God, this is something I've, you know, you have much more chance of running into really great beer.
Right. Mm-hmm.
On that note, we're going to take a short break and we'll come back to talk trends and highlights and all kinds of things of the craft beer situation here and abroad.
With Chris O'Leary of Brew York, New York. The Man About It.
Hi, I'm Mike Edison for Heritage Foods USA, and I want to tell you a story. Sam Edwards of S. Wallace Edwards & Sons has been one of Heritage Foods' greatest partners and a Heritage Radio Network sponsor for many years. Sam produces some of the greatest ham in America, cured in an old world style for up to 400 days until they are perfect and ready to serve. Sadly, though, Sam's entire facility in Surrey, Virginia, was destroyed by a fire early this year, including his smokehouse and literally thousands of hams. It was an incredible blow to everyone that is part of the Heritage Foods USA chain. We now had thousands of hams that Sam normally would have smoked and cured. Our entire network of family farmers who depend on Sam's business every week were potentially devastated by this loss. Incredibly, our extended community of cure masters came together and helped us out by boosting their heritage charcuterie production, starting new curing lines, and helping us turn a disaster into a new Heritage Foods initiative to better the quality and taste of American charcuterie through the use of pasture-raised heritage breeds. Heritage Foods is now able to premiere a brand new selection of ham, bacon, and salami from true American artisans with generations of experience behind them, dedicated to the art of curing by hand, even as we continue to offer Sam Edwards fantastic hams while they are still available and help him rebuild his business. Heritage Foods USA has been a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network since day one. We hope you'll visit our website, heritagefoodsusa.com, to learn more and check out our entire line of steaks, chops, provision, gifts, including this amazing cured ham I am eating right now. Wow, this stuff is good. It could change your life.
Hi, I'm Sherry Bayer, host of All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network, a weekly show dedicated to behind-the-scenes talents in the hospitality industry. Tune in on Wednesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to hear about the incredible careers of top restaurant and hospitality professionals. Plus, on each episode, I tip the show off with a PR tip, feature a speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question, which ties the series together. Support my show and all of Heritage Radio Network's programming. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to become a member today.
Welcome back to episode 206 of The Men About It on heritageradionetwork.org. We're here in the studio with Chris O'Leary of BrewYorkNewYork.com, and we're talking all things of his beer adventures and travels. Really, since Mary and I are starting Fifth Hammer Brewing Company. We're just trying to harness wisdom and corporate espionage into all the great things of the all your favorite things of all the tap rooms.
And we are not traveling right now.
Right, we are unable to leave, and just, we are living vicariously. And also, what? So you said ratio is one of your favorites, and why?
So right out of the gate, they weren't an IPA-focused brewery, whereas every brewery in Denver seemed to be right out of the gate, hey, check out our IPA. So that I really appreciated about them. I love their aesthetic, too. I think that matters a lot in traveling a lot for beer is, you know, how they present themselves in their tap room. It's clean. It's a welcoming environment. It's got a beautiful outdoor space. So that I like about them too. I think their beers are just really clean, simplistic. They don't overdo it. Usually they only have like six or eight different beers on tap in their tap room. So it's not overwhelming to go in there and get a good idea of what they make.
We went there.
We did.
Going to say you've been there before, right? Mm-hmm. That's why it stands out to me. And it did right from my first visit, which was on a day that my good friend from Denver and I visited 12 breweries in a day.
Oh my God.
started at noon and showed up at ratio at midnight. Oh my God.
So how do you go about like the logistics of this? You've been around to 138?
Oh, yeah. Yep, so far this year. Yeah.
How do you go about like planning these kinds of things? Is there like a lot of planning, or at this point 5 years down the line, are you just like, all right, I'm waking up going to three breweries today, that's just part of my routine?
It's a little of both. It's a little planning and a little bit of like happenstance, you know. Like I love plotting out a day where I like look at a map and I'm like, okay, there's breweries here and here. Oh, there's a cluster over here in this like industrial park. That's usually how I go about officially planning, but there will be days when I'll just wake up and know that I have like one or two places I want to hit, and then I'll naturally see where the day takes me. And one of my favorite things to do is, even if I have a whole plan in place for say a weekend in a city, the first like two or three places I'll go, I'll ask everyone I talk to at the bar, you know, the staff there, what are the places where you like to drink in town? What are the places making good liquid in town? And that's really how I, you know, let, you know, that's how I prioritize. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes I'm really optimistic about how many breweries I'm going to be able to get to in a single day. That 12 was a, that was a record for me, and probably won't be repeated anytime soon. Given
how many, how many breweries did you go? The day after. Yeah, exactly.
And also that two of them somewhere in the middle there were a little hazy.
Do not do this at home. That is what you say.
Do not try this at home.
Yes.
I kind of get to prioritize based on what I hear from other people. You know, the craft beer community is great. And, you know, if you pick the right brewery to start your trip at, you'll get so many recommendations that you might not even, you know, there may be things that you weren't even on your radar, like a place that opened 2 weeks ago. You know, I've been to breweries when I've just happened to be visiting cities that are open, you know, for a week. So, and it's really interesting to see how they're presenting themselves on, you know, in early in their lifespan as a brewery, and then come back to them like 2 or 3 years later and mm-hmm. see how they've matured. And you can get a pretty good idea, I think, early on, about what their direction is, but it's interesting to see how they might stray from that direction. I think a perfect example is Threes here in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. You know, Greg Dorosky was like, I want to make farmhouse beers, and he's making IPAs 6 months later.
And food or fermented lagers.
Yes. Yep. it's fun because you can actually see a brewery that's not on your radar. And yeah, that happened to me with Ratio, actually. I think it was about a month into Ratio that I visited them for the first time. And that, you know, I was instantly a fan.
Yeah, I looked up photos because I was like, yes, now I remember it. That was a super cool space. I think it was really crowded when we were there, so we only stayed for a couple of beers.
Yeah.
So let's talk about trends.
Yes.
Also, what are we drinking right now?
Oh, yeah. Real quick. This is the Club Tropicana from Tiny Rebel in Newport, Wales. They won Great British Beer Festival Best in Show in 2015. I was at the festival that year. I was a big admirer of what they were serving at the festival. And now every time I go back to the UK, I have to pick up a few cans. So,
and it's a cool can.
Yeah, it is a really cool can. This is a tropical IPA. So it's got notes of, they say, pineapple, passion fruit, mango.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to get those too.
Yeah. Some sort of tropical fruit.
This is the kind of beer that I want to be drinking on a day like today.
On the beach.
If there is an IPA that I want to drink.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Is that a trend?
Beers on the
fruit
beach.
IPA.
Beers on the beach.
Fruit beers, definitely. I mean, this is something I, you know, continue to see is fruited IPAs, mm-hmm. you know, as much as the purists want that trend to stop, there's no getting around that.
Look, if people are drinking it, then.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong.
No, exactly.
With it.
Like, it's exactly. It's like you don't have to drink it just because right. they make it. Yes. But right. clearly they're making it because there are people drinking it. So
Yeah, exactly. So
obviously one of the biggest trends that I've noticed, I think everyone's noticed, is the New England style IPA. Mm-hmm. And I was just shocked at how quickly that trend spread geographically. So when I went to Vancouver in January, I had spoken with people who had been in Vancouver 3 months ago and hadn't seen a single New England style IPA. And I went in January and there were like 8 breweries making New England style IPAs. I mean, I feel like the trend really accelerated towards the back half of last year and has really just continued to pick up steam. I mean, I was just over in the UK 2 weeks ago, and it was astounding how many breweries I saw making them over there. And on top of that, I noticed a trend. What was it? Three units a trend? Is that what we're saying? But sure. I noticed that breweries were putting out in the UK a New England style pale ale, which was a hazy, sessionable take on the New England style IPA for people who are more attuned to low alcohol beers there. So so it's taken on a life of its own where there are now regional variants on a regionalized style.
So in the UK particularly, were you seeing most of these New England style IPAs with like super juicy hops or British hops as well?
It was all American hops for the most part. And I think one of the challenges that, you know, I was speaking with Paul Jones at Cloudwater while I was over there, and he says, you know, they'll never be able to make a New England style IPA as good as we can make it here, just because by the time the raw materials get to him, right. they are not nearly as fresh.
But what about cryo hops? That yeah. could be, I don't know if they're getting them over there
right.
yet.
Yeah,
I think cryo hops are a game changer for a lot of the smaller brewers here. And I know that they're being introduced to homebrewers at HomebrewCon in Minneapolis.
Oh, very cool.
So I think we'll see. Anyway.
Someone can confirm. Just tweet at us.
Yes. I think I saw that on Facebook recently, and yeah. I'm pretty sure it's true. What else have you seen? What else are brewers doing? Like style-wise? Are you seeing like more and more common?
I mean, apart from, you know, I know I mentioned fruited stuff. I feel like brewers are certainly going out of their way to offer more sour offerings. And they're also using Brett a little bit more. So I'm seeing those, you know, breweries are expanding their horizons. And I'm happy to see that, but, some may be doing those styles improperly. You know, they might be getting a little too adventurous for what their capabilities are as brewers. But I think we witnessed, I can't remember, were you at the Craft Brewers Conference in Portland?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So if you recall, the kettle souring seminar there
yes.
went into a second room because there was just so much interest in it. And this was 2 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And it's just incredible.
I think that was 3 years ago.
Was it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, maybe two.
2015.
A little over.
Right?
Yeah.
A little over 2 years.
A little
years
over
ago.
Two, yeah.
But. You know, there's obviously interest there. So I'm happy to see that and happy to see that brewers are testing their limits. But sometimes some beers are better left in the drain than.
Yes, got to have good practices and know where to dump.
Yeah.
Process.
Yeah.
So one other thing. So back in the day, you know, new brewery would open and they would have your general lineup, right? They might have a blonde ale or their interpretation of a lager, something to appeal to very light beer drinkers. Might have like a pale ale, an IPA stout. And now more and more breweries are opening up with a theme like farmhouse ales or I mean, you know, you name it, they're doing it. So what, how is that? What are you seeing out there?
So as much as I'm seeing that, and I'm really happy that that's happening, where, you know, brewers are opening with a lineup that is not like what we saw 10 years ago. Surprisingly, there are still a lot of breweries out there who are just doing that same lineup that was interesting 10 years ago and just isn't now. And it just feels so uninspired. I often, when I see it, it's in a place where there aren't a lot of other breweries. So there isn't a lot of competition. So they're not forced to test their, as I said, test their limits as brewers. If, you know, when they were home brewers, made those style beers and didn't really dabble in, you know, using Belgian yeast or experimenting with, you know, different ingredients or lagering. So I think that's one thing that's troubling, is that those breweries are probably the ones we talk about the craft beer bubble bursting at some point. I've definitely been someone to say that I don't think we're really at that point yet, but maybe we're getting close now. You know, there's still more openings and closings, but the ones that will be most likely to close will be the ones that, in the face of competition, don't innovate and continue to offer that kind of lineup.
Right, and that's not only through their lineup, but quality of beers too. Like, obviously, you don't want to have somebody that's doing a lot of experimental styles, but not doing,
but not,
you know,
good.
They're all laced with diacetyl and butyric.
Exactly.
We don't want to drink those beers, right?
That's what we were doing.
I'm really happy when I see a lager on a menu at a brewery tap room, and I'm like, that's usually the first thing I'll go for. But, you know, if it's a diacetyl bomb, then maybe I'll take your IPA next.
What did you find in Vancouver?
Yeah.
Oh, so Vancouver was just the consistency of the quality of the breweries was a lot more dialed in than I expected it to be. I know you, Mary, you mentioned Toronto, but I've found in Toronto, you know, it's kind of the ratio of good breweries to breweries who are still trying to find, you know, find their balance and find exactly what their niche is. That's a higher ratio, whereas in Vancouver, it's the scene tended to be very consistent, and I'd like to think that's because of the influence of breweries in the Pacific Northwest. You know, the breweries in Portland and Seattle that have been well established for years, and that's not to say there are some breweries in Vancouver who have been around for close, you know, for over two decades. But the new stuff that's opened within the last like 2 to 3 years has been really impressive. And there's actually in a town called Port Moody, which is just outside of Vancouver, just to the east of Vancouver, there is a single street that has four breweries on it. They call it Brewers Row, and it's
<That's>
amazing. Yeah, and they're all open. I went on a Friday night, and they were all open, and, you know, just bounced from one to another and tried their whole lineup. And each of them had something a little more distinct to offer, which, you know, I appreciate, because, you know, if all four breweries are the same, why would you even bother?
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So they kind of work off of each other in the sense that, in fact, two literally are next door to each other. Like, I think you could barely fit the table that this is on in between the walls of the two breweries.
That's pretty funny.
Speaking of distinctive beers, what are some of the more interesting beers that you've had? Is there any that, like, stick out?
And,
yeah.
Any particular beers?
Ooh. Yeah, like, with like, either a local ingredient that you know, haven't seen used as much, or...
Or an interesting flavor combination.
Yeah.
Or interesting hops combination.
This is a tough one right now. So I would first start by saying, one of the beers that stands out most to me, and I'm trying to remember the name of it right now, and like frantically looking at my notes from that trip.
Thank God for Untappd.
I know.
Untappd. Whatever site that you use.
Yeah, this is literally the only thing I use Untappd for, is for my own reference. So thankfully, this comes in handy right now. There's a So Magic Rock stands out as one of my favorite breweries that I've visited this year. And they primarily make American-style beer. They're in Huddersfield in the north of England. But what I was really impressed with is when I had their English Pale Ale called the Magic Spanner, which is traditionally served on cask, it was one of the best beers I had from them. You know, they're really great at making American style beer, but they're also really good at making, you know, the styles that are traditionally brewed in their own backyard. So that's honestly, I think that's the best beer I've had in the past month.
What was the ABV on that?
That's a good question. See, of course, as soon as I pull away from it, it's like, but I know it's under 4. I think it's 3.8, which is, you know, it's nice to,
that's awesome,
to have something like that.
Have you been, so you've gone to England several times. What is the trend of the popularity of cask ale at this point? Has it been kind of,
it's a very touchy
harder
issue
to find?
Yeah. No, it's a very touchy issue because, you know, we're drinking this beer from Tiny Rebel. So when they won the Great British Beer Festival in 2015, there were some traditionalists at the festival who were saying to each other, and I overheard conversations that these guys are too American. And what they meant by that was not even necessarily the styles they were making, as much it was the fact how much of their beer was going into kegs versus cask. You know, I find that a lot of the pubs that I end up frequenting in London, you know, I may go for the cask beer just because there's very few places here in the States that are doing cask beer well and with a broad selection of beers, and there I can get it. But you know, there are other people who are locals coming in there who, because they're really into this whole craft beer scene, and you know, a lot of the trends they're mirroring where we are too, they're drinking a lot more keg beer. And then, I mean, there's also the fear of the diminishing of pub culture there too,
right.
Where people are moving away from drinking a beer in a pub and moving away from that social experience where you put down your phone and have a few beers with friends. Mm-hmm. It's a challenge for them. I mean, it's a little bit easier here because we don't have that ingrained culture. But it's also a challenge for breweries there, because you'll find that's one thing that's a challenge when I visit there. You know, I want to visit all these breweries, but and for the most part, their tap rooms are only open one or two days a week because they don't want to compete with the pubs.
Right.
Because they fear that having their tap rooms open will actually take business away from the culture that they're actually trying to support by by selling beer. You know, I don't think we have as much of a problem with that here.
No, but there is legislation that is
has been or is
being introduced for that exact
in Texas
same,
right now.
Yeah. And Maryland,
example.
Too,
oh, in Maryland,
I think,
too.
Yeah. So, but going back to brewery tap rooms, what are some of the fun, like, cool things that you've seen in brewery tap rooms, or just things that, you know, struck you as a very appealing?
I always like...
Could be the gamut. It could go anything from bathrooms to tap handles to seating, whatever.
I love beautiful outdoor spaces, well-landscaped outdoor spaces with views. You know, those are the ideal. Knowing that that's not always possible, I like my tap rooms to be airy. Although I do enjoy every now and then a musty room about the size of the studio that happens to serve craft beer too. They all have their own character to them.
Yes.
I do enjoy a tap room that overlooks the brewery, so you can actually see, you know, where the liquid you're drinking was made. I always appreciate that because you feel more of a connection to what you're drinking. So I appreciate that too. And also just sometimes it's the people. It's the people who are reflective of the place I am. So a perfect example, there in Traverse City, Michigan, where I was last weekend, there is a company that runs kayak tours to breweries. So these people come in off of a boat in Traverse City, Michigan. It's oh my awesome. God. So like you have people coming in off of kayaks, like walking into a brewery to drink beer, and you know it kind of adds to the character of where they are. Or you know, I was in Anchorage, Alaska once, and you know, I think half the people I was sitting next to at the brew pub I was at Glacier Brew House, were somehow involved in the oil and gas industry and talking about their experiences or how they shot I don't know, 10 or 12. I don't know anything about moose hunting, but they were bragging about their pursuits in moose hunting. So yeah, the people add character to the brewery, yeah. and you want to create an environment in your tap room that will bring the people that you want to be back.
Right.
That's, you know, if some people complain that some tap rooms are a little pretentious, and I'm like, well, maybe they don't want people coming in to drink 12 beers and get wasted and
right.
puke, you know, in their bathroom.
Exactly.
Yeah. Because, no one wants that.
Because inevitably most of the people who open breweries didn't open a brewery to be a bar owner. They right. opened a brewery to run a brewery.
Yes.
So I can totally understand that. And I have great appreciation for the brewers who don't even want to open a tap room, because there's reasoning behind that. They're not just space, but just not, you know, they don't
want to run a bar situation.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
The one problem now is that we, you know, we're now seeing where the model used to be that a majority of your beer would be off premise and you'd serve a little bit on premise. It's now, some breweries are serving 100% of their beer on premise, and they're not brew pubs. These are breweries that just have tap rooms that are serving 100% of their beer out of their tap room. There's a brewery where I grew up in Rhode Island called Tilted Barn, and you know they claim to have almost never sent a keg off their property. And the only time their beer has left their property has been in the last 3 months when they started canning. Or, you know, in a package of their own versus a growler.
So, how big of a system are they?
Gosh. Well, I know that they are using 7-barrel fermenters for their canning, but they may be doubling up batches. Mm-hmm. So, but still, you can get a good idea of the range there. I mean, they're relatively small, but still, they're only open for a few hours a week. Wow. And all of their beer, all of their beer is served on premise.
I don't think that's a good business model.
Yeah. Okay. So one, that's huge in New York City, right? We all, I'd say the majority of our breweries here are using, not all of them, but the majority are using a mobile canner, and either most of them are selling their cans on premise. They're having a can release usually on the weekend. Sometimes they're doing pre-sales. How much of that are you seeing outside of New York City?
It's a little less prevalent outside. The buzz is a little less so outside the city as it is in the city, and I think that has to do with just the way we've kind of put our local breweries on a pedestal. I think deservedly so. but certainly mobile canning has allowed me the opportunity to bring beer back from places that I've visited, from smaller breweries than would be able to afford a canning line. And even over in the UK, there are several companies doing mobile canning over there now. They've gone one step further. There's innovations in canning labels now. So Northern Monk in Leeds was a perfect example of just, they had these beautiful cans that where they partnered with the artists on the labels, and they actually have a peel back.
Oh, that's cool.
And on the back, it describes both the artists who participated and the beer that they collaborated with another brewery on.
Like over-the-counter pill bottle.
themselves.
Yes. Exactly.
Oh, they, instead of side effects or warnings, that's awesome. Yeah, that's super cool.
So, you know, it's cool to see that kind of innovation on the packaging front, too. And we no longer have to pour our beer into glass growlers where they're susceptible to all sorts of issues.
And a pain in the ass to fill a lot of times as well, depending how busy. So what's coming up? Where are you going next?
So my goal, so embarrassingly, as someone who has the moniker Brew York, New York is a state where I've only visited 70 breweries in New York State. I've been to 105 in Colorado and 90 in California. So,
and we have 326 locations. Yes, we do. With 26 being, or 22-ish being second locations.
Yeah. So I have a lot of work to do in New York State this summer, and so I'm going to try to stay local. There's a lot of places even in the Hudson Valley I haven't hit that I've really wanted to. I want to go up to Hudson Valley and Beacon. I haven't been to Suarez or Sloop yet, so I'm going to work my way up the Hudson Valley. I might go up to so this is a question that I get asked a lot. How do you visit so many breweries in a day? Well, ride sharing helps a lot, and unfortunately in upstate New York it's not legal until the 29th of this month.
Oh, yeah,
finally.
That's right. I just saw that.
So I'm going to try to work on Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, Albany this summer as well. So,
cool.
And then all the new ones that are slated to open in the city here in the next few months will certainly be in my agenda too. But my next overseas trip will be to Amsterdam. And then I'll be back in London in September for the Beavertown Extravaganza. And always planning, I'm going to the Friday session of the Beavertown Extravaganza because most brewery tap rooms are open on Saturdays in London.
There you go.
And I want to leave my Saturday open to visit some more places.
Awesome. Perfect. How about any smaller cities in the U.S.? Besides, I mean, upstate, there's plenty of smaller cities.
Yeah. I usually try to get up to Portland, Maine. Mm-hmm. I've already been once this year, actually, but I may actually head to Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Cool.
That's another small one that has a really really impressive scene for a town its size. Kind of anchored by Smutty Nose, but there's a whole lot of other places and the Portsmouth Brewery, and you know, there's a whole lot that's opened in that area as a result. Another city that I'm aiming to visit for the first time this year is Bend, Oregon, which is an embarrassing
one to have missed
black mark on my travel experience. So working on that one too. And I do want to visit Missoula, Montana as well.
Cool.
That's Montana is a fascinating place. So I visited Bozeman last year, and Montana, every brewery brews a Scotch ale.
Really?
So I want to go to the birthplace of virtually every
Montana
brewery brews a Scotch ale there, because Kettle House, which is in Missoula, had their flagship beer out of the gate was Cold Smoke, and everyone kind of followed suit.
So fascinating.
Want to go back to the root of why that all happened.
That's amazing.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, dude, thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course.
We can always
catch where
up
can
with
we
you
find you on the internet?
So I'm on most platforms as brew_York. And you can find me at brewyorkneworyork.com, or if you are really lazy and can't type that many letters, brewyork.beer.
Nice.
All right. Thank you so much. Now I'm inspired to keep visiting. I have, I think, two breweries in New York City that I haven't yet visited that are open. So I'm just trying to get back to all of them this summer.
I just finished getting to all of them to keep
for
up.
This year?
Well, for this month, because let's be honest.
Yeah, right.
There'll be
exactly
more. Yeah. So there's more where that came from.
Awesome. Well, so get out there and visit that local brewery that you have never been to.
Yep. There's a flavor of experience for everybody. The men about it. Thank you, Chris O'Leary. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Fresh Pickings is a podcast by Heritage Radio Network presented by Bob's Red Mill. Love learning about food? Get more superfood for your brain with the featured podcast miniseries, Fresh Pickings. Go to bobsredmill.com/freshpickings.
Farro is an ancient grain with an impressive pedigree, clouded by tenuous designations and contradictory classifications. But at the end of the day, it's a delicious, versatile, and relatively accommodating grain. So we're going to hopefully clear up some of the confusion and understand farro a little better. To do that, I'll be talking to Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past, about this grain's storied history. Then I'll head into the Roberta's kitchen to get their porridge recipe and find out why the Roberta chefs are so fond of farro. Welcome to Fresh Pickings. I'm your host, Kat Johnson. Stay tuned. You may know that farro is one of the so-called ancient grains, along with quinoa, buckwheat, chia, and more. As the name implies, ancient grains are those that have been changed very little by selective breeding from their original domesticated varieties. In other words, they're basically the same as they were 10,000 years ago. These days, ancient grains is kind of a buzzword. You'll see it in newspapers' food sections, on Cheerios boxes. Even Papa John's gluten-free crust is claiming ancient grains as ingredients. But obviously, they're not new. And in the past, they were better known as heritage grains. Here at Heritage Radio Network, that word holds a lot of meaning for us. So to talk about what heritage actually means, I went to Patrick Martins, who founded Heritage Foods USA and Heritage Radio Network. Patrick, can you tell us exactly what heritage means when we're talking about food?
Well, on the most basic level, Kat, a heritage breed is one that's been unchanged by selective breeding or genetic modification. I founded Heritage Foods USA to create a market for heritage breeds of turkey, pork, beef, and chicken. Farmers who grow these breeds can't rely on commodity markets because the animals take time to grow. They just aren't suitable for factory farming, and that's a good thing. Heritage genetics preserve biodiversity, and ours are raised without antibiotics using traditional farming methods. Plus, they taste a hell of a lot better.
I will vouch for that. So does the same concept apply to heritage grains?
Totally. In the same way that heritage breeds haven't been changed to suit factory farming, these heritage grains haven't been modified either. These older strains of wheat and grains are gaining more and more attention because they taste better, they're better for the world.
So in the case of meat and plants, heritage not only means traditional, it means that it's better for our health and the environment.
Yes! Eat more heritage foods!
When we're talking about ancient grains, farro is about as ancient as they get.
I'm talking farro with Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past here on Heritage Radio Network. Linda is a culinary historian and the perfect person to take us back in time. What's the story with farro, Linda? How old is it really?
Farro dates to the inception of domesticated plants and the advent of farming in Mesopotamia, or the Fertile Crescent. So we're talking about 12,000 to 9,000 BC. For a long time, farro fed almost the entire Mediterranean and Near East. It's been found in the tombs of Egyptian kings and is said to have fed the Roman legions.
Wow, that's pretty old. So is the farro that we eat today the same as what the Egyptians and the Romans ate?
Farro is a term commonly used when referring to three ancient wheat varieties, or triticum. Today, they're very popular in Italy. Spelt, the first variety, is called Faro Grande, or Big Faro. Emmer, which is Hebrew for mother, is called Faro Medio, or medium. And the third and smallest of the varieties is Einkorn, which is German for one kernel. The Italians call that one Faro Piccolo, or little Faro.
So with all of these differences, who's eating what and where?
Regional differences in what is grown locally and eaten as Faro, as well as the similarities between the three grains, has definitely led to some confusion. Emmer is the most widely available in the United States and by far the most common variety grown in Italy. The mountain regions of Tuscany and Abruzzo are covered in it.
So why is Emmer so popular?
Emmer is considered higher quality for cooking than the other two grains, and it's sometimes called the true Faro. Spelt is much more commonly grown in Germany and Switzerland, where people use it in much the same way, as is épeautre, or French for spelt, in France, and might therefore also be called Faro. Emmer is often confused with spelt, though it is entirely a different species. To make things even more confusing, Faro and barley are often referred to interchangeably because of their similar characteristics.
So when exactly did Faro become popular in the U.S.?
Some would say that Faro is an overnight sensation in modern cuisine. It's actually been on menus in the United States for several decades, though historically it was rarer and harder to get. In fact, American chefs used to fight for supply, as Faro allocation here was like fine wine. Thanks to increased availability and the ever-growing interest in rustic Italian food, Faro has grown exponentially in popularity in the last few years.
Whenever I look out of the Heritage Radio Network studio, I look right into the Roberta's dining room. I usually get really hungry for pizza, but sometimes I have to explore the other parts of the menu. One of my favorite non-pizza items at Roberta's is the porridge. So I went inside the kitchen to ask Chef Jackie what goes in this dish. Hi, Jackie. Thanks for having me in the Roberta's kitchen today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Welcome.
So tell me about this dish.
This is our Faro porridge. It started out, we actually did a version of this dish in the winter, so it was a little bit heartier. We were doing it with kale and some other winter veg. But as spring rolled around, we kind of just wanted to create this lighter version of it because it was pretty popular. Would you like to hear about it?
Yes.
So we just cook the Faro really simply, just in water with a little bit of salt. That's it. And then on the pickup, we mix it with a pea puree that is seasoned with shirodashi, which is just a Japanese dashi base. It gives it a lot of umph, you know, that little, like, in the back of your brain flavor that you're not really sure what it is. A little bit of Parmesan cheese, some English peas, and grilled asparagus. Right now we're using fava leaves. Sometimes we use pea leaves. It really just depends. And then we are finishing it with some mint and arugula, which we're getting from our garden.
Why did you decide to put a Faro dish on the menu at Roberta's?
Well, it's just really a versatile grain. Pretty popular right now, actually. People really are into grain bowls and stuff like that. So, I mean, including myself, when I go out to eat, it's like what I want to eat, some grains and veg and, you know, light and healthy. So that's kind of how we came to that.
Do people usually have this as a meal by itself?
Yes.
Nice. Or with a pizza.
Or, yeah. Yeah, everything on our menu pairs well with pizza.
Yes. And tell me some other ways that you like to cook and eat Faro, either at the restaurant here or at home.
At the restaurant, because I have access to certain equipment, like a deep fryer, I really like doing crispy grains, crispy Faro. So cooking it and then letting it air out a little bit so it loses some of the moisture, and then frying it and mixing it into other grains so you get that nice little crunch.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks, Jackie. This is awesome, and I can't wait to eat this.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Chef Jackie of Roberta's for sharing tips for using Faro. You can find the recipe for Roberta's porridge at bobsredmill.com/freshpickings. Be on the lookout for the next episode of Fresh Pickings. In the meantime, you can learn more about Bob's Red Mill's favorite ingredients and check out some delicious recipes and great coupon offers at bobsredmill.com/freshpickings. Bob's Red Mill is a believer in good food for all. That's it for today. I'm Kat Johnson. Thanks for joining us.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.